There we go.
Okay, so, but Steve has to leave during my talk, and so he insisted that I would give the punchline right up front. So, Steve, I'm going to talk about these two saddle points, and I'm going to argue that, now I have to be careful, that this one doesn't contribute. Yeah, so see you next time. So the no-boundary idea goes back all the way to the beginning of quantum cosmology when Lemaître wrote his first paper on the quantum origin of the universe in 1931. In fact, it's even shorter than Stueckelberg's paper by a few lines. Of course, he didn't have a path integral, but he did have an idea.
Insect remains? He didn't write that.
This is not part of the paper. I think this is part of the other paper. A very broad journal, right? Yeah, exactly. Nature, yeah.
And the title was like this.
Oh, yes, this is the title. The beginning of the world from the point of view of quantum theory. Like all great papers, it's written...
The journal was called No Bound.
His idea of a beginning was in way, in very much like a horizon, a boundary to the region of the universe which has any observational influence on us. And it's that idea, in fact, which was later implemented in the no-boundary wave function and leads to the time-neutral formulation and the emergent physical errors of time in each individual history, as Jim described. So there's a root of this idea going back all the way. Now there's a question how, building on Jim's talk, there's a question how you're gonna write down the no-boundary wave function. And because it's almost Neil's birthday, I'm writing it down as a Lorentzian path integral here. But I'm not going as far as saying that this contour needs to be Lorentzian as well. I think it's meaningless as a physical principle because the physical errors of time emerge in the time-neutral no-boundary wave function in a very nice way. And I think it's meaningless as a mathematical principle, because the Laplace integration is not gauge invariant, as is well known. So I'm going to work with different principle. The principle that Jim evoked, namely that we're going to pick this contour, different contours define different possible quantum states, or integral representation of different possible quantum states, in such a way that the resulting quantum state is normalizable to be consistent with the predictive framework giving probabilities.
I'd like to state that the Laplace integration is gauge invariant.
I agree because the Laplace parameter is a gauge degree of freedom, and integrating over it makes the integral gauge invariant.
The point is that when you switch...
Integration itself is gauge invariant because once you fix a gauge, the things in that gauge are gauge invariant.
That's a different statement.
No, it's the same statement. It's exactly the same statement. The Laplace integration in the proper time gauge, which is n not equal to zero and it's shift equal to zero, it's a gauge invariant solver. Just like the rest mass being the mass in the rest frame is Lorentz invariant solver.
In the way that it is implemented in these mini superspace models, it depends on the specific definition of your scale factor. But that was at the core of this morning's discussion, as you will see.
Well, mini superspace.
Exactly, mini superspace. This is going to be my principle. Of course, it's extreme. The way to test this principle is not by just looking at small fluctuations. It's been established long ago in a million different ways that the no-boundary wave function predicts Gaussian fluctuations when they're small. But by going to large fluctuations, you really test whether this proposal with an appropriate contour stands any chance of succeeding. And so that is clearly an extremely interesting realm to go to and to test the proposal. There are two cases where this has come up in recent years. One case is famous. This is the regime of return inflation, where the wave function of the fluctuations around some classical background, which I've written down there, which is Gaussian in perturbation theory, becomes so broad that every indication is that the distinction between the classical background and the quantum fluctuations breaks down, and the naive extrapolation of the dynamics leads, in fact, to anti-damped fluctuations, the multiverse, and so forth. So clearly, the same classical formulation of the no-boundary wave function, in whatever way your favorite way of writing it down is being tested in eternal inflation. And it is perhaps not an accident that eternal inflation happens when the scalar field potential is extremely flat, which means that the situation is very approximately the sitter.
Wait, for m squared, phi squared, it also happens.
Eternal inflation, yes,
of course,
sure.
But it's not fluid.
Well, it's flat compared to the value of the potential. For m squared, phi squared, this inequality holds when phi is larger than 1 over square root m. Yeah, same thing. Flat compared to the potential. Now, a second case where this was then recently emphasized is something which, a result which builds on so Polyakov reasoning as well by Job, Jean-Luc, and Neil, which have argued, well, that even just for gravitational waves in the sitter space, there is this contribution from saddle points which are subdominant normally for small fluctuations, but may become relevant when the fluctuations are large. So to illustrate what is going on here, if you were to, in Jim's spirit, derive probabilities for predictions, the resulting probability distribution for the fluctuations, the tensor, say, as a function of their amplitude, would be nice and Gaussian, with a width set by the cosmological constant. But then way into the tail, there would be this spike up, leading ultimately to a non-normalizable state. So clearly, that's an extremely important point to settle. If there is such a non-perturbative contribution, what does it mean? Does it mean that the theory breaks down? Is it interesting in new physics? Whatever. So it's a very interesting question. So I'm now going to discuss a toy model in which we can gain further insight in this question. And the toy model is an anisotropic mini superspace, which is basically the L equals 2 gravitational wave in the sitter space. The metric or the ensemble of metrics has two scale factors, P and Q, in this model. Their ratio measures the anisotropy. And we're going to proceed entirely in the spirit of the Lorentzian part, taking the Lorentzian part as a starting point. With here we have the action, which is a function of these two scale factors. And we have the Laps. And we're going to evaluate first the integral over Q and P in the same classical approximation. And then we're going to be left, as you saw this morning, with an integral over the Laps. And we're going to look at how the saddle point structure is in that Laps plane. The boundary conditions on the solutions for P and Q, which we're going to substitute to semi-classically evaluate that integral, are such evidently that P and Q match certain final values, which are the argument of the wave function. And they obey initial boundary conditions, which we're going to take to be the no boundary conditions, namely that Q and P at the South Pole equals zero or zero. Those regularity, those no boundary conditions still allow for a discrete set of different boundary conditions on the wave function at the South Pole, so at QP naught. A choice has to be made on those boundary conditions, and this is one of them, and I will discuss later the other choices. So now we're going to proceed in exactly the same way as was done this morning, by solving the equations for P and Q, substituting these in the action, and we get an effective action, or a reduced action, which is a function of the laps, and these final values, P1 and Q1. We have one integral that remains to be done over the laps with a given contour. This is the contour.
These factors of I, were they meant to be there?
Oh, maybe not. Which, where?
The action.
Yes.
Q1, yes. The action should be real, no?
No, why? There's a phase.
Real fields.
Oh, there's a...
I think that the last term had a factor of I.
But there's an I here as well.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. But the action itself should be real for real fields.
None of the solutions for P and Q are complex, of course. The saddle point solutions are complex.
That's not the saddle point, that's your final.
That comes from the complexity of N later on.
No, I told you that we're evaluating these integrals in the same classical approximation. So we're looking for saddle point solutions of P and Q, which we are substituting in the action.
I think it's, is it your boundary conditions that bring the I in?
But the final values are real. P1, Q1 should be real. Right?
Yeah, sure. P1 and Q1 are real. Yeah. But the saddle point solutions are not meant to mean, we're complex saddle point solutions all the
so
time.
So real equations with real boundary conditions, so it's not possible for the action to be complex.
The solution first. That's the question. How does the classical solution become complex if the equations are real and the boundary conditions are real?
Well, it might. It may have to do with this condition.
What is that condition?
So regularity here allows for two discrete boundary conditions on the momenta of Q and P at South Pole.
What is the meaning of the prime?
Prime will. In the psi dq, evaluated at Q0.
But you don't need the condition on momenta, right? You just fix Q0, P0 to be 0.
You do.
And Q1, P1 to be some final real.
Then the equations are ambiguous.
You don't need to say anything else.
You do. That's the point.
If these are second order equations, you only need two conditions.
The point is that these are automatically, the equations are such that these amount to one condition. Requiring Q to zero implies P to zero and leaves another condition.
I would be interested in seeing the details because it seems surprising to me.
When you have boundary value problem, you might get discrete set of solutions.
That's what's happening here.
Yeah.
And Jonathan will tomorrow interpret this boundary condition in more general terms. So these are the solutions. And these are the saddle points. There are three saddle points, one up there on the imaginary axis, and two saddle points down here. And we're going to choose a contour which is a closed circle around the origin, so that the wave function satisfies the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. The gray regions are the regions where the integrand increases, and the white regions are the regions where the integrand decreases. So a Picard-Lefschitz analysis tells us to deform this contour in this one, picking up the lower two saddle points only. Then, of course, the position of these saddle points is dependent on P and Q and their ratio. They move out for larger overall P and Q. And an interesting way to plot the resulting probabilities as probabilities for histories is to plot these as a function of the ratio of P over Q in the asymptotically overall large volume limit. In other words, this model describes a one-parameter family of anisotropic deformations of the Sitter asymptotic de Sitter universes, parameterized by an anisotropy parameter, alpha minus 1 plus P over Q. Alpha is 0 for isotropic de Sitter space. And you see that the resulting probabilities, if you exponentiate this, damp anisotropies both on both directions. So how can this be compatible with what you heard this morning? This is what you heard this morning, summarized, which is the same calculation but in a different gauge, different choice of scale factor, and perturbative in the sense that phi 1 is now, it's probably still on the blackboard, phi 1 is this thing, eh? That's why. So it's a little, so QQ now is an overall scale factor and phi is like a perturbation. The saddle point structure looks different. We have the two saddle points which were picked up in the previous calculation in the lower half plane, but we have the two other saddle points off in the complex plane that are picked up in this calculation. However, this calculation assumes something. It assumes that phi is everywhere less than 1. It's a perturbative calculation. That assumption is in fact violated. It's badly violated, as I will now show. This is the same complex Laplace plane, but the colors now indicate the regions of the Laplace plane where perturbation theory is valid. The green regions is where perturbation theory holds. That's where the saddle points lie. These are the branch cuts. The orange regions are the regions where this term, which they neglected, is important. And the red regions are the regions where phi, in fact, diverges.
There should be
equal
zero.
Yeah. So the statement that perturbation theory holds for sufficiently small perturbations phi is probably true near the saddle points in the green regions, because there everywhere your solution is well behaved. But in order to make any statement that all four saddle points contribute, you have to get from here to there. You have to get with your contour to a red region. In other words, you have to do a different calculation, which includes back reaction. We've pointed this out to these authors, and we're waiting for a replacement of their paper. We're waiting. Meanwhile, however, we've done the calculation ourselves, and we've shown that if you include back reaction, you can't get with any contour from here to there. Therefore, there is absolutely no evidence for large anisotropies in the boundary state. There is no deformed contour that picks up all four saddle points.
Which back reaction do you want to include?
I'm going to include all back reaction that's needed in order for the calculation to be consistent. If phi diverges, you have to include this term. In fact, this is also a linearization. The real potential is e to the phi.
Real potential for what is e to the phi?
For anisotropic perturbations. In this gauge, it is.
What anisotropic perturbations do you have?
These are just L equals 2 gravitational waves. The L equals 2 gravitational wave mode non-linearly.
So you want to tell me non-linearly, everything will be reduced to exponent phi.
So, but how can...
Yeah, and some other stuff.
How can... So you're reducing...
Yes.
So you're reducing your system to two harmonic, I mean, to two... It's a mini superspace model.
Yes.
And you're saying now these gravitational perturbations, L equals to 2 gravitational perturbations can become large. But then obviously this is no longer, then they're going to, in the full theory, they're going to couple to all other L's. So,
yes.
So how can
it's
this
going to get worse. It's going to get worse, yes.
So
I'm just explaining you why this calculation does not lead to, does not allow you to define a contour that picks up all four saddle points. This is within mini superspace. 2 degrees of freedom, like you have here.
No, but what you say is that you have some kind of uncontrollable thing where you cannot do contour.
Off shell, Slava.
You
I'm talking.
Off shell, I can do my slide. Yeah. Because if you go to complete anisotropy, okay, for instance, if you consider all these kinds of problems, you will not be able to solve any equations.
What do you mean? These are the equations.
How much more do you have?
Is it about 10
minutes?
Well, it depends on Slava.
No, I shut up. Okay, so but here I think made the main state. I forgot that I promised you.
Yes.
So you might wonder, where are these other upper saddle points in the calculation that I just gave? The other saddle points correspond to a different boundary condition at Q0. If you pick a different boundary condition, you get a different wave function defined by a different contour over the laps, which produces a different state. Right? Here is a quick summary of the calculation for different boundary conditions. And as you can see, a different contour. And that picks up, a la Picard-Lefschitz, the upper saddle points, and it leads to divergent perturbations, just as we heard. Of course, now I come to my principles. Which of these two distinct theories should I take? I'd say let's take the one which predicts normalizable fluctuations and well-defined probabilities. I have, in fact, I'm only 22 minutes.
Yeah, about 10 minutes left.
Okay, so now I want to switch gear and, well, not switch gear, in fact, I want to go further on this line that this physical principle of requiring the state to produce well-defined probabilities is in fact a very interesting selection principle, which selects among all possible solutions or combinations of solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, those which are physically reasonable. And that is in fact precisely in line with the program of holographic cosmology, which, as Jim briefly evoked, defines, so to speak, the Hartle-Hawking wave function in terms of partition functions of dual field theories defined directly on the final boundary in terms of Euclidean field theory part integrals. And there it is the field theory which defines both the dynamics and the state. Now, you could do some calculations in toy model field theories. In particular, you can calculate those partition functions directly on the final surface, which in this anisotropic mini superspace is a squashed sphere. You could calculate those partition functions in vector models. The resulting probability distribution that you get is qualitatively similar to the one that the Hartle-Hawking wave function predicts. A is alpha, it's the anisotropy parameter. This is zero anisotropy. And this is the region which was causing all the problems if you include these other saddle points. It's the region of the parameter space for negative anisotropies in this case, in this parameterization, where the action of the normal saddle points changes sign, and where you would expect, if there was a contribution through holography from other saddle points, you would expect problems in that region. Recently, Stephen and I have extended this program of applying the Hartle-Hawking boundary condition to, in the holographic context, to eternal inflation, where we have hints that a similar process is going on, that holography, in fact, strongly suppresses final boundary surfaces which have wild fluctuations. So that's a paper which is entirely devoted to use lava because it potentially cuts down the multiverse. So here are my... Well, that's this thing. If large fluctuations are suppressed, the overall structure of eternal inflation will become a lot smoother. So here are my conclusions. I claim fluctuations are damped in the no boundary state and all is fine. Normalizability is what comes in as a selection principle because I have different boundary conditions at Q naught. Where is it? And that relates to this momentum condition, which you mentioned earlier. And different choices for that condition on the momentum of the wave function will define different states. And that this will lead to different predictions or no predictions at all. Thank you.
So you, can I rephrase it in saying that you just choose the contour, whatever contour which will give you normalizable wave functions? And what would you do if there would be multiple contours which give you different predictions which are all normalizable? Would you then say, well, there are multiple theories available, but we need more principles, or?
So you're questioning the uniqueness of I don't know how this program will extend to broader and broader mini superspaces, of course. Eh? Is there going to be always a unique one or not? I have no clue.
And is there a fundamental reason why you take the integral below the pole in the original or the calculation and a different calculation you take?
Normalizability. Normalizability.
Sure. Okay. That was what I wanted to do.
Yeah, so, well, on the question of back reaction, I think we are not, this is something we still have to look into. I wanted to ask something else about the holographic context. How does the holographic definition give you the contour on the gravity side?
Ah, well, that was my motivation for this kind of, for looking into this anisotropic mini superspace model. I didn't know anything. And in fact, no one in the entire holography community has, as far as I know, ever written down a bulk gravitational particle. They've always written down sums of saddle points. So naturally, you wonder whether there is any bulk gravitational particle that corresponds to that holographic calculation. So that was my own motivation to look into this. Can I find a contour in anisotropic mini superspace, which reproduces the no boundary wave function without additional saddle points in agreement with holography? And so there is implicitly, clearly, the holographic theory implies some contour if the bulk state can be expressed as a gravitational particle.
Are you saying that the CFT implies this contour of going around n equals zero in a circle?
I'm saying that the CFT partition function, when you take the same classical limit, produces a sum of saddle points, which can then be organized in terms of saddle points of a Lorentzian particle with a specific choice of contour.
And And that is this contour that you showed.
Well, in this model, it is, yes. Because that's, but I'm doing this phenomenologically, right?
Yes, but it's interesting.
That's the contour which reproduces.
I would say it's interesting that holography would not give you the Lorentzian.
Oh, no, 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 no. DSCFT is very much a complex generalization of Euclidean ADS-CFT. In fact, if you wish, this whole business about holographic formulations of wave functions is very Euclidean. The field theory is entirely Euclidean, and you might wonder how you get any kind of Lorentzian time evolution.
When you say holography, do you mean DSCFT?
Well, this was very short, of course, but it's really Euclidean ADS-CFT and a complex generalization of the saddle points that play a role in Euclidean ADS-CFT are the saddle points, are the usual Hartle-Hodgkin saddle points. So holography is very much a Euclidean story.
So you're saying in a general cosmological context, that would be the contour to take, the circular contour.
Yes, yeah. Also our previous paper in which we chose this contour,
yes.
It's equivalent to.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, the circular contour doesn't look equivalent to the color.
It is.
Why is it equivalent?
It picks up the same saddle points.
Not in one-dimensional models, right, where the circular contour would be zero.
In your calculation, if you take a closed contour, it picks up the same saddle points. It's obvious from the ascent lines and the descent lines, and the closed contour picks up those ascent lines, and you deform it on the descent line. I can quickly show that. That's.
I mean, there's a value to closing that contour on the positive.
No, no, no. You never go to infinity. No, no, no. You just follow the descent lines.
Yeah, there's a 1 over d to the 2. So there's a prefactor of 1 over n to the d over 2.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So
you can't go through that.
So that affects. You need to be in even dimensions for the closed contour to make sense.
But I still don't
think it's equivalent.
Well, that shows it's not equivalent because if it. Well, the branch cut is one reason, but even you know you cannot deform something that goes to two wedges of convergence.
Yes.
Into a circle. That's not possible.
Oh, you mean the equivalent? No, no, I mean equivalent as to which saddle points it picks up. You can't.
I mean exactly.
Oh, no. Of course not. No, no.
They're not exactly equivalent. Okay, so what's your asking now with respect to this object that you propose?
Well, my takeaway message of this anisotropic model, which we now performed branch cut free, is that if you want to do Picard-Lefschetz, and the remaining path integral over the Laps, you better work in a system of variables where your function is analytic, where you have no branch cuts, and in which your boundary conditions at Q naught are exhibited explicitly. I think these are the two mistakes you're making.
Let's have one last question.
And that is just, and the fact that you can't go through is just a manifestation of that.
Let's have one last question.
Well, this isn't exactly a question. I just want to address the issue you raised of what happened if you didn't get any wave function that was renormalizable. It's quantum mechanics, right? So it has to predict probabilities, and there has to be some kind of condition on the wave function where those probabilities add up to one.
Yeah, but
that's the decoherence functional in decoherent histories. So there are situations in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, I think, right, if you have a 1 over r to the 50th potential where you just can't find any of them, that means you don't have a 1 over r to the 50th potential, then it's the theory is wrong somehow. So Neil promised this afternoon to explain, or sometime, to explain what quantum mechanics you are using.
Okay. It might be slightly cheating, but I want to follow up on something I think Stefan asked. That'll be the last question.
I'm sorry.
Which is...
That's what I get for saying.
It seems like you've introduced some sort of meaty superspace or something a little bigger than a meaty superspace.
That's right.
But within that thing, you don't really have exact solutions to the Einstein equation anymore. So how much can we trust the large... when you make it
fluctuation to be large.
It's
how trustworthy is that? I think Levin made a similar point. No, it's not Bianchi.
Because other people don't like
The problem there was at large L.
Large what?
And you're not looking at large L.
L?
L of the moon.
The problem is... There are two types of Bianchi 9. There's the biaxial Bianchi 9 and the triaxial Bianchi 9. So,
this
there's
a truncation of Bianchi 9.
But maybe the larger question, I mean, what you were saying is that if you include these more degrees of, I mean, the higher L's and you treat them fully non-perturbatively, this kind of destabilizes the result that you get when you treat them perturbatively or something. But then what is telling you that if you include the L equal 3, that would destabilize what you're saying.
I think we've accumulated a large number of very good questions for the coming discussion.
So,
after lunch and tomorrow.